Welcome to the It Could Be Said podcast. My name is Will Calling, and I'm joined as always by the one, the only, Dr. Luke Middup. How are you today, Luke?
I'm very good, thanks, Will, and yourself?
I'm very good too. And after our rowdy Brexit and Progressive Alliance special, which you should make sure to read, if you want to listen to a good argument, we're back to talk about the elections, and we're going to start the day with, I suppose, a big story in town, which is the Labour backbiting, blaming, attempted fight back from a very poor set of local elections.
A very poor set of local elections, an unprecedentedly poor set of local elections. We'll get into the ways in which this is unprecedented during the course of the show. But yeah, this is apocalypse territory. This is end of the Labour world. This is the last movement of Armageddon, basically.
And as we'll get into the actual details later, but I think the key thing is it does seem like the Labour leadership isn't handling things well. I mean, this is one of the things I say to people when they ask me, is that, do you think the polls are right? And I say, no, there's no way 30% of the people could vote for Jeremy Corbyn to be Prime Minister. That's unthinkable. They must be on a much lower figure than the polls are showing. And if they're not, they will be by the end of the general election campaign. I mean, one of the things that kind of showed Corbyn in a very poor light was how he handled the results. I mean, it's never nice to be presiding over historically bad losses for your party, but usually leaders do kind of appear around 11 a.m. to kind of explain why things have gone wrong, rally the troops, put on a brave face. The guy didn't appear till about, 5, 6 o'clock? You know, he sent some tweets out around lunchtime when there was finally some good news. And what it seems like is that Corbyn and his closest advisers were in the bunker, desperately trying to blame those poor Labour activists, bless their souls, who'd actually gone out door knocking. There's talk of him trying to get details about the number of activist activity in areas where they'd lost. This isn't becoming of a leader of a major party.
No, it isn't. And even worse, when he did his sort of faux victory rally in Manchester in the evening, one of the few bright spots for Labour, he forgot to invite the victorious candidate, Andy Burnham. These people literally can't organise the parade.
Well, I mean, this is one of the issues you have with the Labour Party, is it really is fear and loathing in socialism now, because the idea they forgot is the best possible spin. The other possible spin is that they deliberately didn't invite Andy Burnham, because if they had invited him, Andy Burnham would have told them to get lost and don't bother coming up, because Andy Burnham, although he was doing his usual fence-sitting shtick, had promised Labour MPs he wasn't going to give Corbyn some good photos on a night where, you know, lots and lots of Labour councillors have lost their seats. However, this kind of shows you this dysfunction has seeped into the Labour team, because Andy Burnham apparently wants Jeremy Corbyn to be next Prime Minister. He certainly wants Labour to return the largest number of possible MPs that they can. So why wouldn't he want Corbyn to have a good photo opportunity to put some gloss on the situation? But Labour's just descending into the worst kind of arguments. And we have another 5 weeks until polling day. You know, in 1983, you know, the Labour Party had to call a press conference in the middle of the general election campaign to confirm that Michael Foot was still their leader. This is going to be awful. It's going to be a long, long 5 weeks.
Yeah, I agree. But, I mean, what I tend to think this is cock-up rather than conspiracy, because they also didn't invite Lucy Powell, who was the local MP in the area of Manchester where they were holding this event. I think it was actually organised by Momentum rather than by the Labour Party itself, which again is going to throw up all kinds of problems during this campaign. The Momentum is going to increasingly, I think now, going to go off and do its own thing.
Well, it's actually quite interesting, because One of the interesting things one of the things we haven't talked about, because it's frankly not very interesting, is the police investigations into Tories that overspending during the last general election campaign. So in Britain, we have quite strict caps on how much you can spend during the legally designated short campaign. That is both on a national level and on a local level. What the Tories were doing was kind of almost like game playing what counts as a national campaign. So they were doing national campaign events in marginals and billing all the costs of national campaign. Now, certainly when you hear some of the details what the Tories did, it does seem like they were taking it a bit far. But all campaigns do this. And you know, Corbyn, whatever you say about him, he's a London MP, he's got a lot of experience of campaigning, and he and the rest of the Labour Party have been noticeably quiet about raising a fuss about this issue. And unlike the Scottish First Minister, he's putting on a tinfoil hat. What momentum counts as during this campaign is interesting, because there is a possibility that momentum are a way for Labour to actually circumvent these hard caps. I mean, I don't think it's a very plausible one, because, you know, it is a company literally owned by one of Corbyn's closest political allies, and it's somebody who until recently worked in his leadership office. But, you know, they are, for example, arguing for Labour their activists to campaign in Brighton Kemp Town to unseat a Tory in favour of the Green Party candidate, rather than defend another Labour MP in another Brighton seat. So they do have some independence from the Labour Party.
I think you mean Brighton Pavilion.
No. Not Caroline Lucas. The Brighton Kemp Town, where the Greens have a deal with the Lib Dems for the Lib Dems to stand down in favour of the Greens trying to capture another Brighton seat off the Tory.
Okay. I think what we're really asking for is, if there's an election lawyer among our loyal listenership, can you please get in touch? Because neither of us are lawyers and we're a bit stumped here.
Well, I mean, I assume that they can't be counted because they're not the Labour Party. But I suppose the point I was going to come to is that if this is a loophole in election law, Labour probably can't capitalise on that much because they don't actually have that much money. But once the principle's established, you know, a rich Tory could easily do this and really start spending money in marginal constituencies. So this is a worrying precedent that might be
set. Yeah, I mean, you could see this as it being the birth of a UK equivalent of a super PAC.
Yes, exactly. Yes, that's a perfect analogy, actually, yes. Anyway, so moving away from the minutiae of election law, which we promised we weren't going to get into, it's not interesting. Labour has some interesting ideas about how they're going to turn back the tide, don't they, Luke?
If you hear a pounding noise, listeners, that's me banging my head on the desk. It's almost as though they see what's useful and then are deliberately trying to do the opposite. So they want Jeremy Corbyn to take a more active role in the campaign. Whereas everything you hear coming out of the Labour campaign is that the one thing people are saying when they talk to on the doorstep is, we don't like Jeremy Corbyn.
Corbyn is so unpopular that he's single-handedly reviving sectarianism in Western Scotland, because a load of working-class Scots are going, he supported the IRA, let's vote Tory. It's literally the return of the old Tory-orange vote in parts of Scotland. That's how unpopular he is. He can physically turn back time.
Yeah, I mean, there are a whole bunch of reasons for this, but I certainly think Jeremy Corbyn is a contributor to the fact you now have Conservative councillors in Shettleston, in Colton, in the east end of Glasgow. You know, if people want to sort of get a feel of the geography, these are places that are literally in the shadow of Ibrox, the Rangers football ground. They're also, by the way, some of the most deprived council wards in the UK.
One thing, so the next big idea is to focus more on door knocking and registering radical students. Now, I thought Corbyn was a bad choice for leader of the Labour Party, but as somebody who is a nominal Labour supporter, I did despair at the establishment candidates. I thought, well, let's see. maybe he can surprise us, or maybe at the very least, you know, somebody from his team could emerge as a competent leader of a future more left-wing Labour Party. So I'm on the Momentum mailing list. And they sent me an email today about how they've cut the Tory lead, which they haven't. But one of the big things was is that, you know, we've had all these workshops by organisers from the Bernie Sanders campaign. Bernie Sanders is the only person to lose a national election to Hillary Clinton in the history of the world. You know, Hillary Clinton had every single advantage in 2008 going up against Barack Obama. She even had, for the beginning stages of the campaign, she even had a strong left-wing challenger splitting the anti-establishment vote. She still managed to lose. She had every advantage, including every single living president of the Republican Party refusing to endorse the Republican nominee, including the previous Republican nominee refusing to endorse the Republican nominee, and she still managed to lose. The only person who Hillary Clinton could beat was an old, cranky socialist. Why is it an impressive thing that you're having workshops about how to campaign, how to win votes from people who lost to Hillary Clinton?
And I think for our American listeners, it's worth pointing out that registering to vote in the UK is one of the easiest things you can do. It's a process that takes all of about 2 minutes. If you know your name, your date of birth, your national security number, which is your social security number, basically, and your address, you can register to vote.
And
so the only people that aren't registered to vote are people that don't care about voting.
And it's also
I think to put it in a way of our former politics teacher, Will, trying to base electoral strategy on getting people to register to vote is rather like basing electoral strategy on raising the dead.
Fundamentally, the non-voter strategy, particularly in Britain, where you know not only is it easy, but you have the government begging people to register, because that's how they know who to pay who they should charge taxes to. One of the whole obsession with non-voters, a bit like Progressive Alliance, but even more so, is that that impulse in parts of the left that you know, we don't like the election results. Let's dissolve the electorate and replace it with a new one. It's like, rather than, you know, make the hard decisions about how you compromise the electorate, how you make yourself more popular, you just wish you had the electorate that would accept you as you are. And it's a terrible, terrible idea. It really, really is. And again, you know, early June is just not a good time to try and get students to vote, because they'll either, you know, in some universities they'll have gone home. In most universities, they'll be either busy with exams or busy partying after exams. I don't think you get much student engagement.
But, I mean, you know this even better than I do, Will. The National Union of Students, the government, even universities themselves, go out of their way to try and get students to register to vote. It's not like the Labour Party has suddenly hit on this vast pool of people who no one's trying to engage with.
No, and the thing as well is that the students who are less likely to be registered are more likely to be right wing. Is that, you know, the very politicised left wing students that they think might rescue them are actually more likely to have registered to vote anyway. And again, it comes back to this thing of you're reinforcing strength. Labour's problem isn't that it hasn't got enough people to vote in the types of areas where there's lots of students or lots of young people. Labour, I mean, maybe different this time, but Labour tends to win those, you know, urban areas, cosmopolitan areas. It's rural England, small town England, from the looks of things, rural Wales, small town Wales as well. That's where Labour's weakness is, and that's where students won't make any difference whatsoever. So yeah, it's a terrible strategy. And again, on the door knocking point, we saw this, back in 2015, Labour talked to far more voters than the Tories. They talked to him in a far more strategic way than the Tories did. So a far more tactical way than the Tories did. And still lost. Because it doesn't matter how many people you talk to, if you have a bad message, they won't vote for you.
In fact, actually, there's some evidence to suggest it makes it worse by reminding people.
Yeah, I mean, there's a famous one, which we'll talk about later, where the then Tory Deputy Prime Minister, Willie Whitelaw, accused Labour of going around the country stirring up apathy, because they just wanted to win on the nod. And the final thing is to unleash a radical policy officer. We won't get into this too much, because we don't really have time. And it does actually seem like Labour is going to do a quite genuinely radical policy offer. I think the days where it was kind of a reheat of Milibandism is probably gone. The likely policies on tax, they're not coherent, but they are certainly clearly to the left of where Miliband was. The one thing I would say, which is interesting about this policy offer, is one of the things I think I'm convinced that they are trying to do is make people, is make Labour members and supporters want a Corbyn government and think it's a great tragedy we don't get Corbyn as Prime Minister, or not so much Corbyn as Prime Minister, but this leadership team getting a chance to implement his policies, as a way of shoring up his vote for the inevitable leadership election that follows after this general election defeat. And so I think when you look at the manifesto, the key thing to look at is if it goes wobbly on the EU, more importantly, if it goes wobbly on immigration, if it's really chucking money around on things like the public services, if it has radical ideas that are particularly appealing to young people, that is Corbyn preparing to go to war against the Labour right after the general election. Because deep down, these guys, they oppose the Tories, but they hate Labour moderates.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I mean, do we actually have a date for the Labour manifesto? Because there's been some confusion about this. There was even talk of them doing a rolling manifesto throughout the campaign.
Look, we've been mean to Corbyn, but that's not unique to them. Everyone's been caught by surprise by this snap election. I mean, the Tories had to delay their manifesto by a week.
What? Yeah, that's kind of my point. I'm not being mean to them. I'm just saying, do we know when they're going to release their manifesto?
I haven't heard anything that it's going to be a week commencing the 15th of May, so next week. I've done that thing we saw the week from Sunday. The following week, but they clearly are doing a rolling manifesto because they are launching policies, whereas Tories haven't started to do that yet. One thing before we leave the section and actually look into the election results in detail, we have to talk about the leadership team. One thing that is quite clear is how few people are doing media appearances for the Labour Party. I mean, their deputy leader, Tom Watson, has been missing in action. I'm sure he's very busy campaigning on the ground, but he's not really been put front and centre in front of the TV cameras. You basically had actually quite a lot of the Corbyn core, and they're not doing particularly well, are they, Luke?
No, I mean, it's Diane Abbott, Barry Gardiner, and John McDonnell, and that's it as far as I can see. And Diane Abbott has made two really, really bad gaffes so far. Yes. But also, talking about the air war, Stephen Kinnock, a Labour MP in Wales, came out with an absolutely extraordinary broadside against Corbyn on the results programme of the local elections, where essentially he called him incompetent. He called him out of touch. And there were a number of phrases in there talking about compassion and patriotism that sounded like a road trial for his own leadership campaign. So not only are surrogates not appearing for Corbyn, there's a small band of them, led by people like Stephen Kinnock, and to a certain extent Clive Lewis, who's sending out some rather Delphic tweets, that seem to be operating on an anti-Corbyn agenda. But yet, they're only surrogates. Barry Gardner, and Emily Thornberry.
Just one thing on that point. So one of the issues you'll have as this campaign goes on is, one, the core Corbynites who are there pushing forward will keep making mistakes. Like Diane, like if we'd have talked about it the last episode, I'd have kind of gone, people are making too big a deal of the fact that she got something wrong about the police, because we all have brain farts like that. It's not a big deal. But she then did it again within the same week, and that was her clearly being slapdash with her facts, because basically she was being interviewed about the results. She was like, oh, I was also around 50, it's not that big a deal. And somebody was like, well, it's actually 150. And then she goes, well, the last time I looked, they're around 100. And just like, what? And so it's like,
I mean, also, that's unforgivable, because she has the numbers there in front of her.
And, well, the thing is, it's that it's not being nimble enough. No, so basically, you're being asked to confirm that the figures are bad. You find a way not to answer the question. Because she's not used to that, she's bad at it. McDonnell's actually surprisingly good at that type of stonewalling. The problem with McDonnell is he's just an awful human being on quite a profound level. I mean, it would be unthinkable for the Tories to put up a chancellor or shadow chancellor that had, say, praised Enoch Powell, the Tory MP who delivered the most incendiary anti-immigration speech in British political history, which not only advocated for immigration controls, but advocated to actually send recent immigrants back to their country of origin. You know, it's a disgusting speech. It really is. And people who haven't bothered to read it don't understand how disgusting this is and how out of the mainstream, even in 1968, it was. But, you know, the idea of a Tory MP expressing admiration for Enoch Powell, a senior Tory MP expressing admiration for Enoch Powell, would be unthinkable. The idea of a Tory shadow chancellor or chancellor speaking in front of National Front, BNP, English Democrats, placards, flags, swastikas, again unthinkable. John McDonnell, you know, today couldn't say he didn't find anything useful in Das Kapital, which, you know, fine, it's a dry economics textbook. But the reason he couldn't say that is because he's on record repeatedly call himself a Marxist. No, he's, you know, he even threw the Mao's Little Red Book at the Tory Chancellor a few years ago. He delivered a speech on May Day, which, you know, socialism is perfect. You know, I'm a socialist, perfectly fine ideology, but, you know, May Day socialist holiday. But he delivered a speech on May Day in front of, you know, I think the communist, the USSR flag, the Ba'athist Party flag, you know, all sorts of things. Lots of evidence of him speaking in front of Trotskyite groups, Leninist groups. So
his worse was his excuse that he didn't see a 10-foot hammer and sickle flag. I mean, does this guy take the rest of the world for complete idiots?
And so, McDonnell, and we haven't even gone to his IRA stuff, because that's a whole other discussion. McDonnell is actually a good performer, but he is so unpleasant that he will be constantly tripped up as his previous associations are brought to the fore by the media. And then, Emily Thornberry is just useless. I mean, she again, it's that thing of not being precise with your language and not realising how you come off. So, like, she's talking to Robert Peston today on Sunday, and he's goading her about how popular Theresa May is. And she just gets into a huff and say, you know, people. And, no, she clearly in her head means journalists. No, she's not actually being patronising. She clearly means journalists. But she says people. People shouldn't obsess about her hair or what shade of blue she's wearing. People should focus on policies. And again, she's thinking about journalists, but she didn't say journalists. So it comes across incredibly arrogant. And they're just not ready for showtime. These are waifs and strays. They are, you know, hard left cranks that were left in isolation when Tony Blair won his majorities. or they are opportunists hoping that these hard left cranks will give them the Labour leadership after this all goes horribly wrong in 5 weeks' time?
Yeah, I think Emily Flaundry is definitely in the second category rather than the first. Just one more point to make. For the third national vote running, Labour's lines to take, that is what its surrogates should be saying to the media, were leaked. Now, for this to happen once is unfortunate. For it to happen twice is careless. For it to happen three times either suggests they have a mole in their media operation, or that these people shouldn't be allowed out of the house with it, you know, shouldn't be allowed anywhere near sharp objects, basically.
Well, I think it was hilarious because they kept getting leaked. So you're actually understating it, because The Guardian got, I think, two or three versions of the talking points. It was remarkable. Anyway, we've had enough punching on a punching Corbyn when he's down. Let's have a look
at this fun.
Let's have a look at why he's down. The reason the Labour Party is flat on its back is the local elections. You know, we often talk about historic election results, historic election defeats, but this really was an historic result for the Tory party. I mean, even at Margaret Thatcher's heyday, they never had in the local elections like this, and they're in government. This is their seventh year in government after implemented pointless, self-destructive, needless austerity that has hurt the lives of people in many, many ways. To give the raw numbers, the Tories gained 563 new councillors and took control of 11 new councils. Two particular ones I'd like to stress are they managed to come from opposition to take control of Derbyshire, and they managed to overwhelm a Lib-Lab pact in Lancashire to become the majority party. And that's unusual for two reasons. One, in English county elections, what you usually find is you have a majority party, they lose some seats, it goes to an overall control, and then maybe if the party gaining keeps momentum, they then go into overall control at the next council election. So to short-circuit that process in the case of Derbyshire is quite unusual. But also, there weren't many Labour strongholds up for grabs in these elections in terms of the councils. These were, particularly Derbyshire, which Labour has never lost when it's in opposition. This is unheard of. Yeah.
And I mean, if I'm sitting in Tory central office right now, the one thing I like about these results, other than the raw numbers, is you have had success literally from Land's End to John O'Groats.
Yes, I mean,
there is literally no part of the country you haven't had at least some success in.
No, it's quite extraordinary. I mean, let's just go with that. I mean, they came second in Scotland with 164 gains, first time in decades they've been the second largest party in Scottish local government. They had probably by most accounts a disappointing night in Wales because they only got 80 gains. But you have to understand that in Welsh politics, there's quite a large number of independents. So the independent councillors is actually the second highest group on the national level. And all the polls going in showed that even though the Tories are likely to do very well in the general election, they're likely to do less well in Wales. But I mean, when you gain in 80 councillors in a historically bad area for you is disappointing. Just kind of show how good a night you are having.
I mean, I just want to point out something more specific, because one of the points that Labour was emphasising, you know, to look for a silver lining in this massive cloud, was that they managed to keep control of Cardiff City Council. Now, when you're having to stress that as a silver lining, you know you're having a bad night. But even so, what that headline overlooks is the fact the Tories gained 13 seats on Cardiff City Council, and Cardiff to put it mildly, is not a naturally Tory city.
I mean, what you're getting a lot of is unwinding of the Labour landslide of 97. Now, a lot of these, not so much Cardiff, but a lot of these areas are places the Tories were competitive or were actually the dominant party pre the Blair landslide. And even with Cameron's, but Cameron still has a very small majority, the smallest majority any party's had since 1974. So there's still entrenched Labour, Liberal, well, more Labour to be honest, Labour parties, and a lot of areas are actually quite naturally Tory, and that and more is coming to the fore. I just want to kind of stress how unusual it is for governments to gain seats like this. So, last time these seats were contested, so you got to remember this. No, this is 2013. Cameron went on to win a majority. He actually improved his performance from the coalition government. Cameron lost 335 seats. Tony Blair, dominant pre-election winning prime minister, two of them with majorities over 100. He as prime minister never posted a net gain of council seats. His closest, and that included two local elections the same day as general elections he won. His closest was in 2001 when he had a net loss of 7. In 1991, the election before the Tories won a very narrow majority of 22 seats, but quite a large popular vote victory over the Labour Party. The Tories lost over 1,000 seats. Even in years where the Tories were, even in 1987, where like this election, that although everybody knew France was probably going to the polls after the election in June. It hadn't been declared yet because local general election campaigns were shorter then, but Labour were ready for it. They unleashed their election campaign. They really did see it as a trial run. The Tories lost 75 seats and then went on to win a 100-seat majority in general election. This is unheard of. You know, normally governments lose seats in local elections and then somehow rebound. For government to gain seats like this is unprecedented. The one exception we'll come back to later when we talk about UKIP, but for a government to gain seats in this number, I mean, if a government, and in 83 the Tories gained 110 seats, that's amazing for a government. To gain 563 new councillors, this is earth-shattering.
Yeah, I mean, like you say, comparisons have to be done from 1974 onwards, because in 1974 there was a massive reorganisation of how local government worked, so there is no comparison you can do before that. But nothing from 1974 to now comes even remotely close to this.
I mean, changing on order, let me talk about the UKIP stuff now, because this will explain the few exceptions. So there are a few exceptions where governments do actually gain seats, and they are basically 1983, 88, 89, and 2011. And what they all have in common is basically you had a collapse in a party other than the opposition. So as Luke mentioned, there's a massive reorganisation of local government in 74. And what it seems like, it took a while for that organisation to take root in how people voted. So until 83, there's actually still a lot of people voting for minor parties. And not just talking about Lib Dem, but like below the level of below that.
So residents, associations and independents, basically. Yeah.
So in 83, you had this weird thing where the three major parties, so Tories, Labour, and what was then the Alliance, so the Social Democrats and the Liberals, they all gained seats. And the Tories actually, I think the Tories gained more than Labour, but less than the Alliance. What you then had in 88, 89, is that the Alliance was in the process of merging, the merger was not going well, it was cratering in popularity, I mean, I think the Alliance in 87 got 23% of the vote. In 92, it got 19% of the vote. So it really was dropping down quite rapidly. And the 19% was good. It was remarkable they got that much. Considering how bad the 4 years, 5 years had gone. So what you then had was that all the councillors the Alliance had won were returning to the major parties. And so in both of those elections where the Tories gained seats, Labour gained more. In 2011, again, the Lib Dems, having gone into coalition with the Tories, were crater in popularity. That caused the Tories to gain some seats in naturally Tory areas, but Labour gained more. So yes, UKIP had this awful night. UKIP lost every single of the 100 plus seats, councillors they were defending. They did gain one, but of the 146 they were defending, they lost them all. But precedent would say that those losses would have scattered to the ashes. Tories had gained some, Labour had gained some. It wouldn't have created this cataclysm.
Yeah.
The fact that the UKIP vote went entirely to the Tories, that all these gains and more were the fruit of the Tories' night, of local election night, is because Labour is so hopeless, is because Jeremy Corbyn is such a bad leader, is because the Tories have pitched their policies closer to the centre ground than any of the other major parties. It's not enough for left-wingers to say, we were never going to win these local elections. No, it's now, Theresa May's taken over. No, Theresa May is now the UKIP leader. That's pathetic. That's making excuses. Every other example where this has happened, the results have been shared. If anything, the opposition's done better. It's because Labour's useless that they've had this result. The fact that UKIP are in the process of disintegration is no silver lining.
And I think the point has to be stressed here, that you've kind of already pointed this out, but if the past is prologue, then the Tories are going to do even better in the general election than these results would suggest. And what's worse for Labour now is they can't just dismiss the opinion polls as, oh, it's just an opinion poll, voters will vote differently once they're in the booth. We now have solid data to indicate that in a matchup between Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn, Theresa May destroys Jeremy Corbyn. This is no longer a hypothetical scenario.
Well, it's even worse. Well, the thing is, they still are. They still are doing that because, I'm not going to go into the details, but these aren't the whole country. So you can't just add up the votes and say this is the percentage of people voting. But there are ways to kind of do a projected share of the votes if in line. And that had the Tories slightly lower than the opinion polls have them. And so you're getting a lot of Labour people, including bizarrely The Guardian. Guardian's leader page, saying, well, the fact that the projected share of the vote for the Tories doesn't match the opinion poll, show it's game on, there's everything to play for. And it's like that projected share of the vote for the Tories is the highest the Tories have ever had in these projections whilst in government. And that includes two elections where they won 100-seat majorities.
Yeah, I've got to say, it's a disgraceful bit of reporting by The Guardian. Because if two guys doing a, tin can podcast can work this out, it's unforgivable that a professional journalist could put that in a national newspaper. It just baffles my mind, Will.
You're absolutely right. To me, when I looked at these results on the day, it's like, well, this might be worse. This might be as bad as 1935 for Labour, which is their worst result. It's the only time. It's the last time Labour went below 200 MPs. If I was a Labour Party, if I was Jeremy Corbyn and I was offered Michael Foot's results,
The point there is they only have to lose 33 seats.
Yeah, this is the thing. We'll talk about this in another podcast, but I'm a big believer in the post-war era. Ed Miliband was the worst leader of the opposition ever, worse than Ian Duncan-Smith, worse than Michael Foot. And Corbyn would do well to match Ed Miliband's performance.
The thing is, there's some evidence to suggest that what Corbyn's team are briefing out is that if he equals Ed Miliband's performance, that's reason enough for him to stay on as leader. I say this as somebody who naturally votes Tory, but I am terrified of where this is going, because for a democracy to work, there has to be a credible alternative government.
Particularly ours. Because we don't have PR and we don't have presidentialism, the opposition, no, we literally have a shadow cabinet, and the opposition is meant to man-mark the government position to position. One thing I would say, if they do manage to match Ed Miliband's share of the votes, they're probably not wrong, as weird as it sounds, because that would mean they gain votes in England and Wales, because Ed Miliband's margin was inflated by tactical voting from unionists in Scotland. So, you know, the collapse in Labour vote happened in 2014-2015. It's just that a lot of Liberals and Tories assumed that the Labour candidate in their constituency was best placed to defeat the SNP. Any further slippage of the Labour vote is not Jeremy Corbyn's fault. Well, it is, but it's part of the unique context of Scottish politics.
Yeah.
So if they manage to match the 31% that Miliband got, that means they gain support in England and Wales, which, again, I just can't see. It's like, this thing is like, people talk about don't trust polls, and you shouldn't if it doesn't conform to your reality. But, you know, I'm a left winger. I know other people who are liberal who are thinking about voting Tory. And so if we're thinking about it, and even if we don't do it, people to our right will vote Tory in large numbers.
And historically, if British polls have been wrong, they all tend to be wrong in the same direction, in that they overestimate non-Tory support and underestimate Tory support. Yes. And this is one of the things that I don't think Nate Silver, the US polling guru, quite gets about UK polls, which is, yes, they're often mistaken, but they're all mistaken in the same direction.
Yes, let's not get into that, because we did a whole podcast on that one. But let's, just one thing, before we go into Labour, one more thing about UKIP. One of the reasons why UKIP has so far to fall, and one of the reasons why I think the Tories did do quite well, was the last year these were defended. So in England, it's different in Wales and Scotland, the baseline was 2013. And that's when gay marriage was being legalised. The law for legalising gay marriage was passed in July. And it seems so bizarre to say now, because it's not an issue, but that was a huge wrench in issue amongst the Tory party. Tory party splits, has to be passed with opposition votes. And it really hurt when activists. They lost a lot of activists because of gay marriage. You know, socially conservative Tories went and basically joined UKIP. And one of the reasons UKIP did well is because they all of a sudden got these activists who actually do something for them, and that has all been swept away. Gay marriage is still on the books, it's not going to go away. But, you know, those people no longer feel like they have a Tory party attacking them, because they don't, because Theresa May is clearly one of them. Not in the sense of she's anti-gay or anything like that, in the sense of she is a conservative Christian and she makes public demonstrations of a Christian faith.
I think that's true. But I also think there's a deeper thing going on here, which is UKIP has always been a party that is dedicated, it's always been a single issue party about getting a referendum and getting us out of the European Union. And like we said before, there may be a purpose that UKIP finds beyond that, but it hasn't found it now. And what you're left with is xenophobia, is racism. But I mean, the whole, we're not going to get into this because we've already done it. But if you listen to their surrogates on the local election programming, all they could come up with was, we're an insurance policy over Brexit. And nobody really believes that insurance policy is needed.
No, they don't. Yeah, I mean, UKIP is imploded. I mean, it'll be very interesting how the broadcasters handle them, because I get very annoyed when people talk about the Greens and how it's unfair the Greens don't get the coverage UKIP has, because yes, I know the Greens have one MP and UKIP had only had one MP, but UKIP had so many more votes than the Greens. It's just like UKIP's vote was very inefficiently distributed. They had came third, second and first in successive European elections, whereas I think the Greens managed to come fourth once, and that was their best ever result. So UKIP were a bigger, more popular party, but that isn't true now. But they have this weird historic legacy of this large European parliamentary party, but that can't mean that their media coverage is inflated now, because they clearly are an ex-party.
I mean, I do think it's interesting that apparently Ofcom are going to do updated guidance based off these election results. So it's quite possible that UKIP's earned media time will go down as a result of this.
Yeah, no, I agree. Let's rattle through these, because we want to leave time to talk about the mayoral results. So we've talked about how cataclysmic Labour's night was. To give more figures, lost 382 seats, they lost control of seven councils. What was a good point for Labour in terms of local elections?
You really are asking for very small crumbs of comfort here. I think two things. Firstly, yes, their losses in Wales were probably not as bad as some people might have suggested, but I wouldn't have been one of those people. So I think the crumb of comfort I would point to is in the mayoral election in the West.
No, mayoral elections. We're going to come to that.
Well, in that case, then I can't think of any crumbs of comfort for Labour, to be honest.
Well, mine would be Scotland, actually, because they didn't do quite as badly as some people thought. They even managed to remain a viable opponent to the SNP in Glasgow City Council. They lost control of Glasgow City Council, but they managed to avoid being completely overwhelmed. The SNP were denied a majority. But yeah, but Wales.
Yeah,
is...
but can I just come back on that, Will?
Yeah.
That's true as far as it goes, but I think a lot of that is to do with the effect of redistribution under under a single transferable voting system that won't transfer across to a parliament, to a Westminster election. I also think that you're dealing with people, particularly in places like Glasgow and Edinburgh, who have such a deep root in the community that they're almost not the Labour candidate.
No, I think that's very true, and let's talk about the SNP as we're on Scotland. I mean, the SNP had an odd night because there has been redistricting, but a nominal boundary is they lost seven seats, so they went backwards. They're still a dominant party. They still won the election in terms of who had the most councillors, who got the most votes. What you have to remember is the baseline for the Scottish election is actually different. It's 2012 rather than 2013. And in 2012, that was before the SNP surge post the 2014 independence referendum. So if you'd seen the same gains for the SNP that you've seen since the independence referendum, you'd have expected them to go forward. So this is a real sign that they've not only gone back from the high water mark, they may have gone quite a bit back. So I'd say there's actually quite a worrying sign for the SNP.
Yeah, I mean, whatever they say, they were expecting to take outright control of Glasgow.
Yes, absolutely. However, as Lucas mentioned, the NATO electoral system makes it easier for unionists to tactically vote and share votes amongst the three unionist parties, which makes it harder for the SNP to get these crushing majorities based on 50% of the vote. But I don't think there's any way to spin it. It was a bad night. You would have expected them to go further. it is a sign that the focus of the independence referendum, of having a second independence referendum, is losing themselves from the goodwill Alex Salmond built up for the party by winning such a good administration between 2007 and 2011. And it does look like that rebranding themselves as a party of Scottish Remain in terms of the EU was a big mistake, because a lot of SNP heartlands in the borders and in northeast Scotland that are leaving the party in quite dramatic numbers, because, you know, quite reasonably, they are Scottish nationalists. They're not going to swap the English yoke for the Brussels yoke. They wanted out of both multinational unions. And how the SNP managed to recalibrate their message will be quite interesting, I think.
Yeah, and I agree with both of those points, but there's also a longer term problem here, which is that a lot of councils in Scotland now are very, very, very hung. And the SNP's cast iron pledge not to work with the Tories under any circumstances, I think, is going to cause them trouble down the line, in terms of, I don't think they're going to be able to maintain administrations in a lot of places, or I think they're going to have difficulty delivering the kind of local services they want to deliver whilst keeping to that pledge.
I mean, it's interesting, I mean, not to go too into the weeds, so STV is it's preferential voting in multi-member constituencies, and the idea is it both reallocates votes from losing candidates, but if you get somebody who wins in a blowout, their excess votes also get redistributed. It's a way of stopping somebody wasting votes by winning by too big a margin. I'm a big believer in STV, but it is designed to have quite narrow. No, it's very proportional. It's the most proportional system you can have. Short of just literally counting the votes and allocating on a national basis. It would be better to have directly elected chief executives of councils if you're going to have STV, because I think this constantly having to have coalitions is going to be a feature of Scottish local government now that they have STV. One more thing to go on to. We were talking about the policy of Remain not working for the SNP. It really didn't work for the Lib Dems, did it, Luke?
Well, I wouldn't go as far as to say that. I think it's very difficult on the basis of these elections to draw any kind of national picture for the Lib Dems, because they were up in some areas, down in others. It's a very mixed bag for the Lib Dems. So I'm not going as far as you to say it's a mistake, but I don't think we can say it was a success either.
Well, no, I disagree, because the key thing is their vote share went up. They managed to lose 42 seats. When they would have gone in hoping to gain seats. I do think they've been hurt by the general election context, because it's kind of focused of mine on some, it may have focused mine on some Tories and got them to come out to the polls potentially. But the key thing I would say is that, and it's something that I wrote about last year, the Remain vote is badly distributed. Yes, it was 48 to 52. But if you look at English and Welsh seats, Leave, by the estimates done by the University of East Anglia, Leave probably won 421 out of 574 English and Welsh constituencies. It's why Labour hasn't gone full bore against Brexit. It's why even the Lib Dems and Greens are a bit leery about being too anti-Brexit. I mean, there's no party saying, let's ignore the referendum, let's just stay in the European Union. And what I do think you're probably going to see in the general election is this same pattern. Not quite the same, but it'll be Lib Dems' vote goes up, but they don't gain the seats you'd think they would, because they'll rack up a lot of voters in, you know, seats they have no chance of winning, either held to by Labour or Tories, and they'll go backwards in seats they could win, because a lot of seats they could win are in the South West that voted Leave.
Yeah, and they did not have a good night at all in the South West. You know, Dorset, they had high hopes of taking a whole clutch of council seats in Dorset and Somerset. That just did not happen. And not only that, they just got swamped by this Tory wave. And like you say, there are the South West has a lot of UKIP voters in it that just bodily shifted to the Conservatives. And so I can't see them picking up seats like Cheltenham, seats like Cornwall North, seats like Midpool, and seats like Torquay, which used to be Lib Dem. And they would have had quite a high hope, based on the raw numbers of taking them back again. I just can't see that happening.
I mean, for me, one of the interesting things is how the parties do their targeting is going to be fascinating, because in Britain, we talk about majorities. So that's about this MP has a majority of so many thousands, so many hundreds. There's a couple actually that have less than 100. And the key thing is it's not a majority. It's a plurality. It is the gap between first place and second place. And so one of the big statistics in British election reporting is the fact that the number of marginal constituencies has been going down gradually. What I think we might discover in this election is that was a bit of a false stat done by the fact that you had this growing non-top two party vote. And now what will happen is you'll get a lot of seats which nobody considers marginal flipping to the Tories because they squeeze that UKIP vote. And so there'll be a lot of Labour MPs whose majorities actually went up in 2015 because the Tories and they both lost support to UKIP, who lose their seats this time round because that UKIP vote goes to the Tories.
I think it's very interesting that when Tim Farron did his morning after the night before rally, he did it in St Albans, which based on the 2015 results, the Lib Dems haven't a cat in hell's chance of taking. On the other hand, it's one of the most Remain parts of England, and they seem to be putting a lot of effort into places like St Albans, places like Vauxhall, where on the basis of the last election, they have no hope of winning, but they're putting resources into them on the basis that they were very heavily for Remain in the Brexit referendum.
If they do that as a strategy, if I was a betting man, which I'm not, I'd put money on them losing seats, because, having a net loss of seats, because I don't know about St Albans, but they're not going to take Vauxhall, because if the fundamental thing is Vauxhall did go Remain, but most people won't care. Most people aren't going to vote on Brexit in terms of relitigating the referendum. They will vote on Brexit in terms of who will get us a good deal on Brexit. But most people actually vote on what they always vote on, which is who will be a good government.
Yeah, and but I mean, in fairness to Tim Farron and the people around him, given where the Lib Dems are, only having 8 seats, and given where their activists are, I think running as the party of Remain really is the only viable electoral strategy open to them.
Maybe, but I think...
What's the alternative? If you're a Lib Dem strategist, or if you're Tim Farron, what's your alternative campaign?
Just because I don't have an alternative doesn't mean this is right. It may just be there's no choice. There's no good campaign.
Well, that's what I'm saying. If you've only got 8 seats, you may as well try something ambitious and have it not work as run just to try and hold on to those 8 seats.
Why don't you lose them all?
Well, they're not going to, so...
Well, no. But say someone like Vauxhall. They're not going to take Vauxhall. It is Vauxhall.
Vauxhall was only... I don't think it's a very good example. But my point is they're putting the resources into seats that were very heavily Remain rather than necessarily putting resources into, their target seats based on 2015.
Yeah. Anyway, let's move on for that. Let's quickly do these mayoral results. So, to continue the woes of people who voted for Remain, these are... local government positions that were rejected by referendum used an electoral system that was again rejected by referendum. But hey, we get them because they've tweaked it slightly, so it's not defying the will of the people, Luke. You ever get the feeling the Tories are trolling the people who voted to remain?
Just a little bit.
So, what was the most shocking news item of the local election results? If you had to sum up the local elections in two words, what two words would you choose, Luke?
Tees Valley. Now, for those of you who are a bit hazy on the geography of this, just to describe what the Tees Valley is in electoral terms, this is Stockton, this is Middlesbrough, this is Cleveland, this is Redcar. And if for our Americans for whom that doesn't mean anything, this is the deepest, darkest shade of Labour red. This is northeastern England, where you don't count the Labour vote, you weigh it. And the Conservatives won that mayoralty. The Sun's Tom Newton Dunn, the Sun's chief political reporter, was speaking to a Conservative Party source the night before the elections, and I'm paraphrasing slightly here, he asked, "Do you think there's any chance of winning the Tees Valley?" To which the official responded, "If that happens, I'll poop in my hands and clap." And they did it, so we're about to launch into our 3-hour special for miles.
I mean, this is, it wouldn't be an exaggeration to say this is almost like the British Rust Belt. This is not places, the Tories are competitive.
Yeah, that's a very good analogy, actually.
These weren't places Tories were competitive when they were booming, let alone now. The candidate, Ben Hosham, mangled his name terribly, so didn't expect to win. He did the classic thing you do when you know you're going to lose. You make a load of promises you don't expect to have to implement, including promising to nationalise the local airport. So I really hope he didn't have a good job, because he's not going back to it for another 4 years.
The look on his face when the result was declared is priceless.
I mean, in terms of the council elections, this is one thing the Tories might run into, is that they did so well. They may just have the odd councillor that hasn't been properly vetted because no one thought they would win, and that might cause them issues. I mean, there was a Lib Dem saying that one of their local new Tory councillors said he was backing Le Pen in the French election. So there might be a few embarrassing stories we get over the weeks and months to come of new Tory councillors behaving badly. Probably the most watched of these mayoral contests, probably should explain what these mayoral contests were. So Britain works on cabinet government in terms of councils, in the sense of you have councils, you vote for your local council within the area, whether it's a county, a city, a town. The party with the most councils get to then nominate some of the councillors to be the cabinet of the council. Tories for a long time haven't really been happy about this, and some of the less traditional members of the Labour Party as well haven't been happy with this. And there has been a desire to have American-style directly elected mayors to kind of bring dynamism into local government, particularly with the idea being that a lot of these local parties get controlled by quite mediocre, not to be too mean, and it's not, I don't entirely agree with this, but what they would say is basically mediocre party hacks. You know, people who couldn't make it as MPs, people who are too extreme or too corrupt or just too uninspiring to get to the next level of politics. And the idea was, if you have directly elected mayors, you can bring new blood into the system. And that worked in the West Midlands, because in the West Midlands, you actually got a businessman, Andy Street, who gives us the brilliant Christmas ads from John Lewis every year. I say brilliant, I don't really like them, a bit saccharine for my taste. But basically, a very famous British department store. And he, on behalf of the Conservatives, beat Labour Sean Simon. It's not deepest, darkest red, we're going too far, but this is the This, as far as relatively marginal areas go, this is the one that's most rock solidly Labour, wouldn't you say, Luke?
Yeah, because when you hear the phrase West Midlands, you sort of, it sort of conjures up a picture. But basically, we're talking Birmingham, Coventry, Solihull, Wolverhampton, Sandwell. So the Tory areas of the West Midlands and Warwickshire and Staffordshire don't fall under the authority of this new position. So it's a definition of the West Midlands that favours the Labour Party.
It's basically Greater Birmingham. I mean, this is a common theme of a lot of these city regions are created, where you have the core city and then you have its surroundings, which, because England is so small, actually often includes substantial cities of their own right. So Coventry and Wolverhampton would be big cities by American standards. But they don't want to call it. I mean, the only one I think that's actually called Greater is Greater Manchester, and then you have Liverpool City Region. But there is this tension between the outskirts and the core city. And I'm sure that helped, because Sean Simon did very well in Birmingham and did less well everywhere else. One of the things that's fascinating, there's a few things that are fascinating about this context. Andy Street basically self-financed his own campaign, and it was very very presidential. There was a lot. He put forward a very different type of conservatism to Theresa May, very much in the Cameron Osborne mould of liberal conservatism, very comfortable with cosmopolitanism. He worked it very hard. Sean Simon clearly had an idea of running a much more low-key campaign that was about getting Labour vote out. When he realised he was in a dogfight with a very well-financed Tory campaign, he tried to get more funding from the Central Labour Party, and they slow-walked the application to the point where he got an infusion of funds, but after this short election campaign started, and so he couldn't actually spend it all because it'd go over the election cap. What you see, so Andy Street basically, they were basically neck and neck on the first round. To give you an idea, the Tories ran behind Labour in the last general election by about 10, 11, 12 points. They were way behind. So the fact that Tories got to level pegging is extraordinary. But it wasn't unpredicted. Most people assumed Andy Street would probably edge Sean Simon on the first round. But this is a preferential system where you get two votes. You vote for your first preference and your second preference. And what people thought was is that Liberals and Green voters and the Communist candidate, they would all unite to rescue the Labour Party. Progressive Alliance in action. Did that work, Luke?
No, it did not. I think this is my silver lining for the Labour Party. Because actually, if you look at it, Sean Simon's vote in the areas where Labour need their vote to hold up, it did hold up in places like Birmingham, like places like Coventry. So, for example, in the general election, that bodes reasonably well for seats like Birmingham Erdington, Birmingham Northfield, Coventry Northwest, Coventry Southwest.
I'm not clear. I'm not sure about that. I'd say this was pretty bad for Labour.
I'm trying to think of something, Will. I mean, I'm not saying I'm convinced by it, but I'm just trying to give our Labour listeners some crumb of comfort to hang on to.
What I'd be worried about is Greens, Liberal Democrats clearly didn't see a difference between Labour and the Tories. So this idea of tactical voting, I think it might be for the birds. One other thing about the electoral system, in West Midlands, everyone knows it's going to be Labour Tory fight out for the second round. That was less clear in other places, and that caused real problems for people actually casting their votes in an intelligent way. And it's not their fault, it's the electoral system. So in Cambridge and Peterborough, the second round, 22% of these second round votes were for parties that had already been eliminated. In Western England, that rose to 31% of the votes for candidates other than the top two, the ones that have been redistributed. In the West Midlands, it was 8%. And the reason is, in both Cambridge and Peterborough and Western England, it wasn't entirely clear who out of Labour and the Liberal Democrats would be challenging the Tories in the second round, particularly in Western England, where I think most people assumed the Lib Dems would get through to second round and it'd be Tories, Lib Dems. So you'd had a lot of Labour voters put the Lib Dems second. A lot of Lib Dem voters would put Labour, I'm getting this wrong now. Basically, things went wrong with that Tory system. It didn't work like people thought it would. And I think that is something we have to revisit, because this supplementary vote system works in London, works in places like the West Midlands, where it's clear who is the top two. When it's a top three or a top four, the whole thing collapses.
Yeah, and it does. It basically forces a duopoly where none exists. But the Lib Dems will be very disappointed not to get to at least to the second round. A couple of weeks ago, they had serious hopes of winning in Western England. I mean, Stephen Williams is a former MP. They basically, as far as they competed in these mayoral elections, they put all their eggs in that Western England basket. So that is a major, major disappointment for the Lib Dems.
And on a final note, congratulations to the man who defines my image of Northern England, a man who is a real working class hero, a man who went to the great evil London and never got seduced by its fancy cocktail parties, dinner jackets or costly coffees. The man who walks around with his own personal whippet and brass band. Congratulations for becoming the mayor of Greater Manchester.
Yeah, Andy Burnham, all those years of splitting the difference have finally paid off.
And on that heartwarming testimony to the potential benefits you too could accrue if you walk around like a caricature of the area you grew up in and sell out all your principles whilst maniacs destroy your party, I hope we will call him. He's been Dr. Luke Middle. This has been It Could Be Said. And please, God, can someone save the Labour Party before the election's over?